everyone, and welcome to the Jus Comune podcast. My name is Emilia Mateix Ferrandi from the International University of Barcelona in Catalonia. And here today, I am very happy to have as a guest, Zachary Hertz, Assistant Professor of Classics at the University of Colorado Boulder, and also a trained attorney. Today, we are going to be talking about his recent publication, The God and the Bureaucrat, Law, Power, and Imagination in the Roman Empire, published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very much for being here, Zach. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Emilia.
Thank you. So, to start with, can you provide an overview of the historical and legal context of the period you're studying to help situate the listeners?
Of course. So, one of the things that really drove this book was that I could never understand how to sort of put the rules of Roman law together with the rules of Roman society as they existed at the time that most of our sources were written. So let me sort of expand on that a bit. I'm studying the imperial period of Roman law. That's when pretty much all of our law comes from, which breaks down roughly into what we call the principate and the dominate. The principate, that's sort of the age of Augustus and beyond, is what you tend to think of when you think of the Roman Empire. It's the rules of it are confusing, actually. So you have this guy who's pretty clearly a military autocrat. You don't want to piss off the emperor or else you'd get killed. But there's a very, very strong convention that government is still nominally Republican and the emperor is just a fancy man that everyone happens to listen to. People who study this period refer to this as doublespeak. There's this kind of persistent people living in this period misrepresent it. They all sort of lie to each other and themselves. And then in the dominate, which is the later Roman Empire, basically after Constantine, things get a little more straightforward. The emperor is more emperor. He's going to be addressed in these kinds of very, very hierarchizing terms. You have a more formalized court structure. You have sort of what you think of in a European monarchy, almost. You have a guy who's running everything and courtiers around him. But the sort of funny coincidence that the book tries to explore is that as the monarchy gets more formal, it also gets more, I hesitate to say constitutional, but weirdly, as the emperor gets stronger, law gets stronger as well in this period. You have, on one hand, this God on earth style of monarch, but on the other hand, he's supervising a humming bureaucracy that operates in a way that seems more modern and legalistic. And I could never figure out a way to make that make sense. This entire evolution is sort of in the background of our Roman legal sources, but they don't talk about it for obvious reasons. And this book is kind of trying to tell the story of how law emerges from this chaotic, informal political system of the Principate and ends up kind of running things by the time of Justinian.
Thank you. And also, your book challenges the common view of Roman law as a coherent, rational, and technical system. So what made you question this traditional view?
Short version, I'm American. You are never going to convince an American that anything is coherent, rational, or technical. That's just not our lived experience, Emilia. But in seriousness, I come from a common law system, and legal training in the common law is really different. We don't think of law as determinative because in the common law, it's generally not. We tend to think of legal doctrines as sort of channeling the moral imagination or normative thinking of judges with some kind of ill-defined powers. That a doctrine isn't going to decide a case, but a doctrine is going to focus questions and help powerful figures figure out what they should do. Roman law really works the same way when you think about who Roman judges are. An important thing that is often missed is that, you know, jurists aren't judges. The people who are actually deciding cases aren't the people with the legal training that's required to read and make sense of juristic texts. If anything, juristic texts are sort of articulating vague doctrines and heuristics that might operate as a rhetorical tendency. And if you're used to reading law in that way, it's very obvious that's what's going on in Roman adjudication on the ground. It's a little less legalistic than the jurists want it to be. And once you see that, you kind of can't unsee it. So as I was trying to sort of explain these documents to my colleagues in law school who were being trained as common law attorneys and to my colleagues in classics departments who work on, you know, Virgil, who work on imperial culture more broadly, this was the only way I could make it make sense to everybody. And I just figured, okay, well, I got to write a book. Let's write this one.
Yeah, but also I have to say you playfully and in a very provocative way start in your summary of the book saying that why is Roman law so boring? So what does boredom reveal about what law really meant for the Romans?
I mean, I think it's a good line. And it is, I think a little bit of provocation is sometimes helpful because Roman law, for people who aren't used to Roman law, you don't expect the book on Roman law to be funny. And I wanted overtly to sort of signal this is kind of for you. But I do think boring is an important part of understanding what Roman law is and how it works rhetorically. I personally think government should be boring. I like government to be boring. And when I say that Roman law is boring, what I mean is that it focuses our thought away from interpersonal dynamics, away from sort of emotionally charged court drama, into this sort of impersonal systematic thinking that, again, is a better way to run a government, but it's a boring way to run a government. And Roman history, the stuff that's happening as these documents are being written, Roman history is not boring. You know, at the time Ulpian is writing his treatises, he has maneuvered his way into being the regent for a child emperor by getting on the right side of a violent coup. He is busily killing all of his subordinates and anyone who might compete with him for power before he is himself sort of pulled limb from limb by soldiers.
Yeah.
And how do you square that? How do you square this dangerous, sort of violent life with ad Sabinum? It is difficult. And I think the boredom of Roman law is kind of an imagined escape from the excitement, and I mean that in a very derogatory sense, of Roman court life in the 3rd century CE.
Yeah, but at the same time then, if they didn't experience that as boring because of this excitement that you talk about, then, well, of course, it's difficult to read into a dead man's, you know, way of thinking. But what do you think then having law will have meant in their everyday political imagination?
I think part of this depends on they, right? Because when we think of Roman law, our guides to it are these very odd people. They're jurists. They're people who are completely immersed in this very specific system of ethical and normative thinking, whose sort of social life, their career, their status hinges on their mastery of this complex system. They're not normal people or particularly interested in talking to normal people. I mean, anyone here who teaches at a school with a philosophy department will be able to relate. And for them, I think they understand that their version of the ideal law might not be enforced, but it's something that's interesting and important in its own right. There's a broader they, though, a sort of broader collection of legal subjects operating under the principate, litigants, people who are sort of making embassies to emperors, trying to figure out how to position themselves. And for them, I think we should understand law as one of many persuasive tools. There's a saying in an American law school about sort of trial advocacy. If you don't have the law, pound the facts. If you don't have the facts, pound the law. And if you don't have the facts or the law, pound the table. And I think it's actually kind of similar. You might make a very legal argument if you think that's your strongest claim. You might operate in different emotional registers. You might lean on personal connections with the fact finders. There are a lot of different ways that a person could go about getting what they want in an adjudicative setting. Law is one of many good ones. And I think that's how most people are going to understand law in the Roman Empire.
Yeah, I think that is a very accurate way of describing a reality that was a bit complicated and or exciting, as we say it in the other way. But then, you know, you also talk about the Corpus Juris Civilis, so the great work of Justinian. So then we are set on the 6th century AD. And then you describe it as an archive of political imagination. Then here we have different layers, right? Because we have the political imagination of the jurists who are, you know, like compiling this Corpus Juris. At the same time, do we count the political imagination as well of Justinian as the new, you know, an emperor who called himself Roman as well? So how does law then become a space where Romans fantasize injustice and stability and is reflected in this archive of political imagination?
So I think it might be helpful to start out by just explaining what the Corpus Juris Civilis is. This is basically the Roman law code as we have it, and it's produced in the early Byzantine period by Justinian I. And one thing that I think we often miss about the Corpus Juris Civilis is nothing in it, except maybe the institutes, you know, no one cares about Justinian's institutes. The Codex and the Digest are not written as parts of a law code. That's not what anyone who's writing these documents thinks they're doing. On one hand, you have the Codex, which is a bunch of answers to discrete legal queries. It's a mix of sort of legislation and rescripts. And there's a lot of different kinds of documents that are all thrown together. And then with the Digest, which is really what we're talking about here, these juristic treatises are not intended to explain how things actually work. These are philosophical documents about how an ideal law might operate. They're not law, they're jurisprudence. And I don't think anyone who's writing juristic treatises is unaware of that. These are abstruse arguments that aren't necessarily meant to be applied robotically by judges. They're ways to think about, really push the edges of the system and hypotheticals. That's not what the Digest is, but it's what the treatises are. When you make these abstract arguments into a law code, you change their generic character. And if you sort of go back, if you think about this as a hypothetical technical literature, I think it's a lot easier to see the imaginative capacities of it. A lot of the Digest is thinking about how a perfect judge might apply the law in a world where they were free from political constraint, in a world where they had perfect information, where it was clear what would happen. And I think that's there in the text if you read for it. And that's just a thing a lot of people would like to exist, even when it doesn't exist. When you describe it in those terms, I think the fantastical aspects of the Digest do start to shine through. It is a text that is much more hopeful or subjunctive, for lack of a better word, than it really became when it was reproduced as the Digest. And then its later reception tradition has kind of acculturated us to read into it.
Yeah. I really like the word hopeful to describe the Digest. I've never heard any description like this. But I would like to pick on a line that you also said that goes perfectly with my next question. Imperfect information. Because, you know, we have all these emperors like Augustus, Adrian, or the Severan that relied on law to legitimize their authority in moments of crisis. But much scholarship, and especially when I read, for example, I read a lot of economic historians, they question a lot about how effective was law and about their enforcement as well. So given this tension, why was legality such a powerful political fiction?
So I think a lot of the answer to this is not, you know, grand musings about the nature of law or, you know, the human heart crying out for regulation. It's a very specific Roman habit of mind. Obviously, we don't have a ton of early Roman law, but early Roman law is clearly very sacred. It's very bound up in Roman metaphysical ideas about the ordering of the world. Dionysus of Halicarnassus, I think, describes sort of the origin of a lot of legal practice as coming out of something priestly, as a sacral arcanum that orders the world in the same way that other kinds of rituals order the world. That's not how other ancient societies deal with law. That's not normal in the sense that it's not something that just happens in cultures. But Romans really, really place use very close to the other sorts of thick notions of ethicality and of communality early on in the game. That makes it a powerful tool to think with in the Roman imagination. And later authors, later emperors, later political actors draft off that. Not super visible in our in something like the Digest, which is 700-800 years later, but Roman law is old. And if you look at that old, archaic legal material, you can see why it would feel very powerful to Romans. They've been taught to think of law as very powerful in an almost supernatural way.
But I'm wondering then, for example, going again to this third century AD, the Severum, yeah, and the juris bureaucrats, let's call them that way. In what way do you really think they are consciously participating in the construction of this political imagination construct, or are they just doing their thing, commenting, you know, in a practical way or in a more theoretical way?
Well, they're dead, Amelia, so we don't really know.
That's true.
But no, it's something I think about a lot, because one of the things I've tried to do as I was writing this book was really put myself in these people's heads, not in a way that's confident, not in a way that thinks I know what's happening here, but really trying to ask, why would a person with recognizably human concerns write Ad Sabinum? You know, that's a real question.
And
I struggle with this.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know the extent to which the different actors writing Roman law into being think their world is more orderly than it is. People are very, very good at deceiving themselves, especially lawyers. And jurists, when they write like this, they're actively reframing public life in terms that they are better at doing than anyone else on the planet. When Ulpian makes law into a technocracy, he's the technocrat, right? And people are very good at fooling themselves into thinking the things that they're best at are the things that really matter. That's something, again, we're all familiar with from our own lives. We're all familiar with this from academic bureaucracy. We all know that this is simply a way people talk. And sometimes they're aware of what they're doing. Sometimes it's rhetorical strategy. Sometimes they're not aware of what they're doing. Sometimes they're working very hard to not be aware of what they're doing. It's hard to figure out exactly what people are conscious of when they're misdescribing reality or elevating particular small features of reality that happen to be ones they've mastered. That's a very human response to the world. Yeah. And I know from my own life that is not something where it's always easy to answer the question of whether these people know what they're doing. I think probably some of them are some of the time, probably some of them aren't some of the time. And honestly, I think that aspect of the subjectivity of the mind of the jurist is probably lost. How does the guy who writes what Ulpian writes kill as many people as Ulpian kills without something happening that's sort of hard for us to wrap our heads around, you know?
No, but I like your answer, because I can see, obviously, that you come from a historical and classical background, because, well, for the listeners who are maybe not aware about this debate, there is this Alan Watson saying, you know, that they are only, you know, like regulating or giving law, the juries, for their own people. They are only talking from their high stand, their high horse, let's say, in a way. Or Schulz also thinking in that way. And then there's other people saying, no, they actually know what reality is about. They are not constructing something. They are regulating for everyone. And I see that this is kind of like, I think what you're saying is way more humane. It's like, I mean, they are doing what they can, and sometimes they are aware, sometimes they are not. And, you know, this is
the
thing that also we will never grasp all the details, of course.
And I do think part of this is American training. American law schools have been, and I think this is largely for the best, taken over by legal realism. We now understand a lot of law as sociological, as hinging on things like, what kinds of schools do judges go to? How do judges understand their own lives? I remember reading a really wonderful book. This is going to be kind of an unexpected recommendation. It's called Vice Patrol by a woman named Anna Lavovsky. I'll email you this info if you want to put it in show notes or something.
Yeah.
That's about vice prosecutions, so sort of sexual offense prosecutions in 20th century America. And it really focuses on the home lives of judges, what churches they go to, how judges understand their own moral universe, and understanding that those kinds of questions influence things like, do you let offenders go? What kind of charges do you accept? What kind of charges don't you accept? And that's just how good American legal scholarship proceeds. We're sociological. We treat judges as socially embodied actors. And yeah. I think once you start asking those kinds of questions of jurists, once you understand the deeply odd society they were imbricated in, a lot of the odd features of juristic writing, you can find new ways into it. Instead of these abstract arguments about, you know, pure philosopher, pure bureaucrat, they're dudes with jobs.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And personalities and life. But then linking that with the title of your book, here, The Emperor, who's also a judge as well at some point in imperial history. So you describe the emperor as the god and the bureaucrat. So in this tension, what does this reveal about how Romans understood sovereignty, like imperial sovereignty?
So I was trained by people who were very, very into a sociologist named Max Weber. And one of Weber's core questions was, what makes an authority worth listening to? In his terms, Legitimenherrschaft. And he has this typology that I've always found really helpful. And it's a little robotic. There's always some nuance at the sides. But he distinguishes between something called charismatic authority, where I'm listening to you because you are a deeply special person who is overturning an old order, and legal rational authority, where I'm listening to you because there is a system that I generally like for whatever reason that vests your words or your ideas or your desires with some kind of authoritative power. The way I think I use this metaphor, I don't use this metaphor in the books. I cut this part out because it was bad. But is someone special in the way that Napoleon is special, or is someone special in the way that the prime minister is special? And over the course of the Roman Empire, you see different emperors whose jobs are very ill-defined, who have a lot of room to sort of represent themselves within this capacious system, really go hard on different ends of this spectrum. You have people who are portraying themselves as gods on earth, and you have people who are portraying themselves as caretakers of this kind of institutional order. And at the same time that this is happening, you also have courtiers around them who are reformulating their own relationships to power and developing something like the autonomous court that we now associate with almost the first civil service in Europe. One of the reasons why I like how vague my title is the bureaucrat might be the emperor. The bureaucrat might be the bureaucrat of the emperor. And, you know, there's a certain point, I would argue, when jurists start to be described in these eulogizing, almost divinizing terms, where maybe they're the god in this story. And you clearly have these two kinds of people interacting. Yeah. One of the reasons why I really liked that title is I think it reads differently at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book. And I thought that was a fun joke.
Yeah, it is. It is. And actually, you know, because I thought of my book when I'm explaining to the students how the right to respond as if you were the emperor, you know, with the authority of the exceptoritate principus, as you were the emperor. And then I thought, okay, maybe he plays a bit on that sense as well, because they are jurists that actually can reply to rescripts as if they were the emperor. So in that sense, are they also, promoting this image of the emperor as well as a god, or, well, when they are the bureaucrats as well? It would be good if you can give us an example about the bureaucrats giving, you know, like the idea of the emperor as god.
So one of the things that I really get into with this book is sort of, it's not just jurists making law, right? Everyone's making law. Everyone's talking about the system. Everyone's bringing it into being. They're producing our archives. And I think the best example of thinking about the emperor as someone constrained by law, and one that a lot of legal historians don't think about, actually comes from a Roman author named Seneca. Seneca writes in a lot of different genres, but my personal favorite text of his, one that is an important piece of Roman constitutional history, is something called the Apocolicentosis, which literally means ascent to godhood. It's a play on apotheosis, but it's replacing God with pumpkin. It's sometimes translated as the pumpkinification of the Emperor Claudius. It's sort of this rowdy satire about a particular emperor sort of going into the afterlife and being judged. And it's quite formally precise. He really imagines an emperor going on trial. And there's been a lot of really good work recently. I want to particularly highlight Erica Bexley at Durham on how much law seems to matter for Claudius in other sources. This is a guy who liked judging trials and did it weirdly. He loved to kind of futz with the law and do things that felt right to him, and he violated trial procedure all the time. And a huge part of this weird fantasy, again, the pumpkinification, it's a funny text, is about what would it look like if emperors actually had to answer to judges? What would it look like if the emperor was submerged in our legal system the same way that we are? And it's a more blunt text than you're ever going to find in a jurist. For one thing, Claudius was dead. You don't write something like that while the emperor is alive. But I do think it shows this fantasy of the emperor being subject to law in a really powerful way.
Yeah. But also, as we're speaking as well, you know, there are several moments of this exciting Roman Empire where there's, you know, there's civil war and there are child emperors, for God's sake. Can you think about a child emperor as a god or as a bureaucrat in a very authoritarian sense? So how does kind of like law can help in this situation, you know, when you have like situations like child emperors governing whole an enormous empire?
Can I get political for a second?
Yes,
Amelia?
Of course. This is a safe space, as it's said.
So I was writing the dissertation that turned into this book. Mm-hmm. Really, it started in earnest. It got off the ground in 2016. And I don't think that was a coincidence. One of the sort of common features of the first term, especially of Trump, was this kind of fantasy of legal order reasserting itself. You would see sort of literally, you would walk into the store and there would be prayer candles with a special prosecutor named Bob Mueller appearing in the place of, you know, the Virgin Mary. It was ironic, but not really. People had this very strong affective attachment to law as the thing that was going to assert itself and make the chaos go away. I think Romans are similar. They wanted very badly to imagine a world that wasn't scary or chaotic or arbitrary. And law was the tool that they used to do that. One of many tools, and for jurists, certainly the primary tool. But this is, I think, a pretty standard human reaction. The idea of turning to law as the fantasized sort of avatar of order, not everybody does that. You know, you have other cultures that deal with this with apocalypse talk. Thinking of Paul Cosman's work on quantification and apocalypse with Jews under the Seleucid Empire. People fantasize about a kind of eschatological consequence, but the idea that something is going to come and make the world good again, that it's going to redeem us is very common. And for a certain kind of personality in a certain kind of state, law is very appealing as that redemptive force. It applies a predictable order in which outcomes are determined by one's ability to sort of nimbly argue under a complicated logical system. If you're a person who's good at that, wouldn't it be nice if that were the most important thing?
Yeah. No, I think you're right, actually, because it's meant to be a safe space as well, no? To give you some red lines, actually, what you can do and you cannot. So, yeah, I think it makes sense that it's describing that way. So I would like to go a bit further in history, because your book also challenges that into late antiquities and medieval. So how does your interpretation of Roman legality help also explain later medieval transformation of Roman law into what we call common law or the jus commune?
So I want to be very clear on this. I'm not a medievalist, and the book is careful here. I think it sort of, there's Justinian. If you look carefully at the chapter on Justinian, a lot of it's not about Justinian. and then, whoopsie, Nazis. I can talk a bit about medieval, because it's obviously an incredibly important part of this story, but it's not one I'm entirely comfortable with. I do think, in general, medieval Europe tends to think about Rome as a dream of order. It tends to think about Rome as a lost period of governmental coherence, when things made sense, when things were safe, when sort of the world was being properly directed. And that makes Roman law especially seem very appealing, because the kind of fantasy that Roman lawyers have about the Roman state, the fantasy we've been talking about in juristic treatises of a coherent, rational system, just jibes really well with how a lot of medieval audiences are inclined to think about Rome already. So when you start seeing the development of the Glossators in, I want to say, the 12th century, maybe the 13th, see what I mean? I don't really know medieval.
The 12th, and then 13th, it gets a bit more in-depth, yeah.
But as you start seeing what emerges out of this glossatory tradition, people want to read Roman law the way Roman law wants to be read. And I do think that's a huge part of how this law becomes bedrock for systems that eventually are a lot more stable, are a lot more technical, are better able to provide legal outcomes and provide regularized outcomes than the Roman Empire necessarily is. Again, I'm not the guy to tell that story. I would take a moment to recommend to some of my readers and books I really like on this. Tom McSweeney's Priests of the Law, I think, is a really, really wonderful account of how this process goes in England. I've been trying to read a little bit more on sort of Anglophone legal historiography of continental Europe. Ada Kaskowski's Vernacular Law. That just these kinds of materials to try to get a better handle on this. But right now, I have to be honest, the medieval period is too much of a lacuna for me to want to speak with authority. Just that you can see a lot of these same representational tendencies recur elsewhere in medieval culture, and that's clearly an important part of the story.
Yes, of course. We will need to include your reading list in the summary of the podcast, of course. No, it's you know, you have this part in your book, in the 7th chapter, that it says why imperial constitutions look nicer in retrospect. So I really wanted to deal in that, because it's true. I think you're right in the idea that people after that had this kind of like concept of Roman law, and they wanted to read in that way, despite the fact that they were sometimes very cheeky and they really applied this concept the way they wanted. Like in the past episode, we talked about Grotius, and Grotius was super cheeky. He really like read Roman law as an authority, but he was really applying it all over the way he wanted.
Oh, yeah. And in that section arises out of, if you read the Codex, you will often have this odd experience of the first constitution in a given title is Justinian saying, everything's horrible. Everyone before me was crazy. They didn't understand this as well as I do. The law has to change. And here's what the law should be. And then immediately starts going into, I believe that in these circumstances, it should be X. And then it's just the most milquetoast, they all agree with each other kind of constitutions once you get past Justinian. And if you want to tell me that Justinian the First was a little freak, I will believe you. That is a weird man. But it also sort of got me thinking, there are a lot of weird men in the Codex Justinianus, and they don't survive that way. And I think a huge rebound of it is that when Justinian says everything else is wrong, here's my wacky rule, they have to include that because his name is on the book.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of constitutions, the kind of chaos that's just dropping out of the record because it's not useful in a law code. I'm going to make an exception. I'm going to change everything. Everyone was wrong before me. Doesn't work well in a document like the Codex Justinianus. And I wonder a lot if actual rescript law especially is much messier and meaner and more rhetorical or sort of more contradictory, arguing with itself, than the Codex Justinianus makes it look.
Yeah. Actually, when I like your portrait of Justinian, because I always think like this guy was megalomaniac in the sense of not knowing his audience. Like he does all this extremely, you know, like complicated work of doing the corpus juris. And then he doesn't realize that nobody's really speaking Latin in the place of the world where he lives. Come on, he needed to get, you know, like later translations into Greek to get the corpus juris to be a success. So it's like, man, you write this book for your, you know, for your own good or something, right? Like,
I really don't know who he's writing it for. I think a huge part of it is just Justinian is writing for posterity. You know, if you look at the authorizing constitutions, this is a guy with a very, maybe it's sincere, maybe it's a representational tendency, we don't know. But he very clearly wants to be viewed as an extraordinary world historical figure. And the Corpus Juris Civilis is a big part of that. The fact that he just sort of figured, well, if you want to know the law, you're going to have to learn Latin. I'm granted, he's also writing for much more technocratic judges. I don't think it's insane to think someone coming out of the law school culture of the early Byzantine Empire might know a little Latin. I don't think that's insane. And I also think translations are probably bouncing around in ways that don't survive before the Basilica. But it is a text that is much more conscious of itself as a cultural product than as a here's what you do if somebody steals your donkey kind of book. That part is in there, but it's really subordinated to the broader goal.
You know, more like what you talk about late in the book. So basically you ask this very important question of like, not what is law, but what law does. So what did law actually did for the Romans living under imperial autocracy?
So, I mean, one important answer is sort of what I'm talking about here is Juristenrecht. Obviously, sort of Romans have law. It's not evenly applied and it's not sort of universal or determinative, but Romans clearly have a law that is adjudicating in low stakes circumstances that are, you know, straightforward. Everyone has some rough sense there is a praetor's edict that might handle certain kinds of antisociality. In terms of what Juristenrecht is doing for Romans living under imperial autocracy, I think it's a tool to think with. And I don't know this for sure, but I think it's interesting. It's a literature. Romans who are reading juristic commentaries are reading them as a way to think abstractly, to get outside of the sort of politics in their own time, and to try to imagine what right might look like. That's a thing a lot of us do. You know, pop ethics is a thing, and a lot of people like reading sort of abstract philosophical notions to try to get a handle on their own moral sensibility. I assume the reading of again, these sort of very technical treatises that aren't really relevant to court is kind of like that. They're passing through as a form of literature. What will happen eventually is they start getting carved up for quotes. In the late antique period, you start seeing these very disembodied statements of legal normativity that circulate throughout the later empire. Things like the Sententiae Pauli, for example, or some of what's going on in the Fragmenta Vaticana. And there, I think people are starting to try to get something useful out of the Juristenrecht. But if you read a treatise front to back, I think you're doing it for something more literary or more sort of cognitively rich.
Yeah. I think you're right. Also, I have to say, like, for example, if we talk about the schools of law and the jurists who were working, for example, before becoming bureaucrats, so the ones who, you know, built the schools in the Augustan period or even before, these people were like, they are law aficionados, right? In a way, right? They kind of read about law. They like to give advice. Probably they like to, you know, tell people what to do, in a way. So what do you, because, I mean, your book, I think it puts a very important milestone here of what, you know, what is law, how to make law also accessible and actually, you know, for historians also when they are reading law, like to understand what they are reading about. So what is your hope for historians or classicists or even for, you know, like a actual Roman legal jurist to take away from rethinking the law as a form of political imagination?
So the book has a lot of different audiences, and I kind of want to get those people talking to each other, and the impact of how that will look is, you know, different for different groups. You know, for jurists, which is, you know, that sort of continental form of Roman civil law practice, this is tricky because I'm not a part of that community, and I have a lot of respect for it, and I don't want to tell people what to do, all joking aside. But sociology a little bit, maybe thinking a bit more about the circumstances people lived in when they wrote these texts, how their lives operated, what kind of emotions would have been in play as they wrote this, what kind of questions might have animated their lives. Those are questions that, again, sort of jurists of other periods are very, very used to asking in certain legal cultures. And I think there's a lot there. I think for historians were a major sort of component of this, I'd like them to be less scared of Roman law. Roman law is a technical discipline. And when I was being trained, I was told pretty overtly, if you don't do these years of specialized work, you can't use these sources. And I found that enraging because the sources are so good. There is so much Roman legal prose, and it is so much to tell us about the Roman world, even if it's not perfectly organizing things on the ground. I like to demystify those archives a little bit to show that they can be read using the tools that other kinds of ancient historians use all the time. And I guess the last thing is I'd like us to read Roman law more as a literature. This is a text that has deep reservoirs of feeling and learning and has a sense of play to it. These are people who are doing something different and stranger than resolving disputes in 6th century Byzantium. This is not the Corpus Juris Civilis. These texts are a technical literature. They're an odd series of ideas that can tell us a lot about the Roman mind. And I understand that sometimes it's really important to know what's just an Ionic and what's not. Sometimes it's really important to see how doctrines evolve, especially if you're in the kind of legal system where you can cite the digest or where the digest ideas are things we live with now. I get that these questions are important to a certain kind of person, but that's not the only kind of person or the only kind of scholar who needs to read these documents. I want them to be played with more than they are. And I hope my book shows that you can get somewhere by having fun with jurists and having fun with Roman law.
Yeah, I really hope so. I think that is a very hopeful aim that you have with this book. And I hope that people will take it like seriously in that sense. So, Zach, I think you had another project as well, giving hope to historians and Roman law. So is there Can you tell us anything about that?
Absolutely. So I, a couple of years ago, was asked to write a research guide on Roman law. And I told the editor, you know, the world needs another guide to Roman law in English, like it needs a hole in the head. I'm not competing with Roman law in context. That book is too good. I use it too often. I'm not better at that than that book is. But all of the guides to Roman law that I've ever encountered are very much written for lawyers. The idea is, I study, say, contract law in contemporary Slovenia. I want to know a little bit about how Roman law operates. This book is going to take Roman law and put it in terms that I can understand. There's very little out there for historians who want to work with Roman legal archives. Earlier this summer, I was talking to a graduate student who works on Roman firefighting. You know, that's obviously an area where you need to read the digest, where Roman law is incredibly important. And the questions that she had are totally logical questions that it is shockingly hard to find an answer to in Anglophone research literature. Things like, if this is written, if the excerpt is attributed to Saturninus in the digest, when was it written? When someone says this is interpolated, what does that mean exactly? Why does this citation look so strange? How do I get from D.X.Y.Z parenthesis Ulpian 5 ad ed to an actual quote in an actual book? That guide doesn't exist in English. So I decided to sort of try writing that. I'm working on it, but it's tentatively called Roman Law for Historians. And I feel like the audience for that book, you know, people who are not super interested in Roman law, but need the archives to deal with their kinds of ancient history questions, that's not the audience for this podcast. But what I've been generally asking of people, and I do kind of want to end with this plug, if there is anything that you have wanted someone to explain to you about Roman legal archival practice, shoot me an email, please. Zachary.Hertz@colorado.edu. Not because I can answer you, not because I run, you know, Tony Honoré's free legal advice service or whatever, but because I really want to know what questions people have. I will look it up. I will try to figure out the answer and I'll put it in the darn book. But I want to get a... I am trying to answer the questions I had as a graduate student and that my graduate students have, but there are other graduate students in the world, and I would love to hear from them.
Okay, great. So we will keep your email also in the synopsis of the podcast, and it will be like Better Call Zach this year. And actually, for example, something that from my own, I think it would be good if you can include, is like, you know, when I started my PhD, of course, I like Roman law. I have studied Roman law in my law graduate course. But nobody had ever told me about the Palingenesia or Lenel or all these people that you need to know. Like you just read, of course, what we were talking about in this podcast. You get the Digest of Justinian and you think, oh, this pretty book with all the organized paragraphs and all that. And then you realize that, no, they are only excerpts. And then you have this guy in the beginning of the 20th century who put them all in order. But I didn't know about this guy before, you know, like my professor there suggested that to me, and then I needed to learn it all on my own. So please help these people to not find Lenel on their own, because it's not easy either.
It's enormously difficult. The rescript Lenels, I mean, my God, you have to, there's a website hosted by the University of Glasgow that you have to go to. And, you know, it's a great website. Thank you, Ernie. But like, nobody knows. There's just so much that has to be explained.
Yeah, actually. And I like this openness because I think, as you have said before, for many years, Roman legal scholars have been keeping our discipline to us because it's difficult and you need all these tools to read the sources. It should not be that way, because actually we have a very pretty useful discipline that can help, historians, classicists, and even archaeologists. I work a lot with archaeologists and they like to know what law is about, but they feel the fear. Because we have this fear to them, you know, like law is complicated and boring and all these kind of things. So I think you're doing a great effort here.
Yeah, law is complicated. Why not someone explain to people how to deal with the complicated thing instead of sort of looking at them smugly?
Yeah, Yeah, of course, of course. And actually, we had this podcast with Peter Riedelberger, who works a lot in the Codex. And he was saying, many texts of the Codex are really difficult because actually, you know, they have patched things together, they have cut stuff. So it's like if you have like a text that is not the whole text, they have like cut a lot of sentences. So it's normal that it's not understandable. But if you don't know that, you read the text and you think, wow, these Romans are really bonkers. They are really writing in a very weird way. So it's good to know, to let them know that stuff as well.
I agree completely.
Yeah. So, well, thank you very much for your time on all this, you know, like all this hope that you have inferred to me and to our listeners that our discipline can go beyond. So really thanks again, Zach, for being here.
Thank you very much, Amelia. And thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you. Talk soon.